miss the initial reports. 2 months ago, Alan Mackenzie Frazier had disappeared from a high school dance the same night his date's body had been found on the school grounds. Cause of death was difficult to determine, as the dead girl's body had been mauled by animals. There had been a pack of strays troubling the neighborhood for the past few months. Authorities had been uncertain whether the missing boy was a suspect or not. Finding his blood led them to suspect he was another victim. Anna touched Alan Frazier's smiling face with trembling fingers. She knew. She knew. She jumped up from the table, ignoring Mouser's unhappy yowl, and ran cold water from the kitchen sink over her wrists, trying to keep nausea at bay. That poor boy. It took another hour for Mouser to finish his food. By that time, Anna had the article memorized and had come to a decision. Truthfully, she'd known as soon as she read the paper, but it had taken her the full hour to work up the courage to act upon it. If she'd learned anything in her 3 years as a werewolf, it was that you didn't want to do anything that might attract one of the dominant wolves' attention. Calling the Maroc, who ruled all the wolves in North America, would certainly attract his attention. She didn't have a phone in her apartment, so she borrowed Kara's. She waited for her hands and her breathing to steady, but when that didn't seem to be happening, she dialed the number on the battered piece of paper anyway. 3 rings, and she realized that 1 o'clock in Chicago would be considerably different in Montana, where the area code indicated she was dialing. Was it a 2-hour difference or 3? Earlier or later? She hastily hung up the phone. What was she going to tell him anyway? That she'd seen the boy, obviously the victim of a werewolf attack, weeks after his disappearance in a cage in her alpha's house? That she thought the alpha had ordered the attack? All Leo had to do was tell the Maroc that he'd come upon the kid later, that he hadn't sanctioned it. Maybe that was how it happened. Maybe she was projecting from her own experience. She didn't even know if the Maroc would object to the attack. Maybe werewolves were allowed to attack whomever they pleased. That's what had happened to her. She turned away from the phone and saw the boy's face looking out at her from the open newspaper. She looked at him a moment more, and then dialed the number again. Surely the Maroc would at least object to the publicity it had attracted. This time her call was answered on the first ring. "This is Bran." He didn't sound threatening.
"My name is Anna,"
she said, wishing her voice wouldn't quiver. There was a time, she thought a little bitterly, when she hadn't been afraid of her own shadow. Who'd have thought that turning into a werewolf would turn her into a coward? But now she knew the monsters were real. Angry with herself she might have been, but she couldn't force another word out of her throat. If Leo knew she'd called the Maroc, she might as well shoot herself with that silver bullet she'd bought a few months ago and save him some trouble.
"You are calling from Chicago, Anna?"
It startled her for a moment, but then she realized he must have caller ID on his phone. He didn't sound angry that she'd disturbed him, and that wasn't like any dominant she'd ever met. Maybe he was a secretary or something. That made better sense. The Maroc's personal number wouldn't be something that would be passed around. The hope that she wasn't actually talking to the Maroc helped steady her. Even Leo was afraid of the Maroc. She didn't bother to answer his question. He already knew the answer.
"I called to talk to the Maroc, but maybe you could help me."
There was a pause, then Bran said a little regretfully,
"I am the Maroc, child."
Panic set in again, but before she could excuse herself and hang up, he said soothingly,
"It's all right, Anna. You've done nothing wrong. Tell me why you called."
She sucked in a deep breath, conscious that this was her last chance to ignore what she'd seen and protect herself. Instead, she explained about the newspaper article, and that she'd seen the missing boy in Leo's house, in one of the cages he kept for new wolves.
"I see," murmured the wolf at the other end of the phone line.
"I couldn't prove that anything was wrong until I saw the newspaper," she told him.
"Does Leo know you saw the boy?"
"Yes."
There were 2 alphas in the Chicago area. Briefly, she wondered how he'd known which one she was talking about.
"How did he react?"
Anna swallowed hard, trying to forget what had happened afterward.
Once Leo's mate had intervened, the Alpha had mostly quit passing her around to the other wolves at his whim. But that night, Leo had felt that Justin deserved a reward. She didn't have to tell the Maroc that, surely. He saved her the humiliation by clarifying his question.
Was he angry that you had seen the boy?
No, he was happy with the man who'd brought him in.
There had still been blood on Justin's face, and he stank with the excitement of the hunt. Leo had been happy when Justin had first brought Anna to him, too. It had been Justin who had been angry. He hadn't realized she'd be a submissive wolf. Submissive meant that Anna's place was at the very bottom of the pack. Justin had quickly decided he'd made a mistake when he changed her. She thought he had, too.
I see.
For some reason, she had the strange feeling that he did.
Where are you now, Anna?
At a friend's house.
Another werewolf?
No.
Then realizing he might think she'd told someone about what she was, something that was strictly forbidden, she hurried to explain.
I don't have a phone at my place. My neighbor is gone, and I'm taking care of her cat. I used her phone.
I see, he said. I want you to stay away from Leo and your pack for right now. It might not be safe for you if someone figures out you called me.
That was an understatement.
All right.
As it happens, the Maroc said, I have recently been made aware of problems in Chicago.
The realization that she had risked everything unnecessarily made his next few words pass by her unheard.
I would normally have contacted the nearest pack. However, if Leo is murdering people, I don't see how the other Chicago Alpha wouldn't be aware of it. Since Jaime hasn't contacted me, I have to assume that both Alphas are involved to one degree or another.
It's not Leo who's making the werewolves, she told him. It's Justin, his second.
The Alpha is responsible for the actions of his pack, replied the Maroc coolly. I've sent out an investigator. As it happens, he is flying into Chicago tonight. I'd like you to meet him.
Which was how Anna ended up naked between a couple of parked cars in the middle of the night at O'Hare International Airport. She didn't have a car or money for a taxi, but as the crow flies, the airport was only about 5 miles from her apartment. It was after midnight, and her wolf form was black as pitch and smallish as far as werewolves were concerned. The chances of someone seeing her and thinking she was anything but a stray dog were slight. It had gotten colder, and she shivered as she pulled on the t-shirt she'd brought. There hadn't been room in her small pack for her coat once she'd stuffed it with shoes, jeans, and a top, all of which were more necessary. She hadn't ever actually been to O'Hare before, and it took her a while to find the right terminal. By the time she got there, he was already waiting for her. Only after she'd hung up the phone had she realized that the Maroc had given her no description of his investigator. She'd fretted all the way to the airport about it, but she needn't have. There was no mistaking him. Even in the busy terminal, people stopped to look at him before furtively looking away. Native Americans, while fairly rare in Chicago, weren't so unheard of as to cause all the attention he was gathering. None of the humans walking past him would probably have been able to explain exactly why they had to look, but Anna knew. It was something common to very dominant wolves. Leo had it too, but not to this extent. He was tall, taller even than Leo. And he wore his black hair in a thick braid that swung below his bead and leather belt. His jeans were dark and new-looking, a contrast to his battered cowboy boots. He turned his head a little, and the lights caught a gleam from the gold studs he wore in his ears. Somehow he didn't look like the kind of man who would pierce his ears. The features under the youth-taut, teak-colored skin were broad and flat, and carried an expression that was oppressive in its very blankness. His black eyes traveled slowly over the bustling crowd looking for something. They stopped on her for a moment, and the impact made her catch her breath. Then his gaze drifted on. Charles hated flying. He especially hated flying when someone else was piloting.
He'd flown himself to Salt Lake, but landing his small jet in Chicago could have alerted his quarry, and he preferred to take Leo by surprise. Besides, after they'd closed Meg's field, he'd quit flying himself into Chicago. There was too much traffic at O'Hare and Midway. He hated big cities. There were so many smells that they clogged his nose, so much noise that he caught bits of 100 different conversations without trying, but could miss entirely the sound of someone sneaking up behind him. Someone had bumped by him on the walkway as he left the plane, and he'd had to work to keep from bumping back harder. Flying into O'Hare in the middle of the night had at least avoided the largest crowds, but there were still too many people around for his comfort. He hated cell phones, too. When he turned his on after the plane had landed, a message from his father was waiting. Now, instead of going to the car rental desk and then to his hotel, he was going to have to locate some woman and stay with her so that Leo or his other wolves didn't kill her. All he had was a first name. Bran hadn't seen fit to give him a description of her. He stopped outside the security gates and let his gaze drift where it would, hoping instincts would find the woman. He could smell another werewolf, but the ventilation in the airport defeated his ability to pinpoint the scent. His gaze caught first on a young girl with an Irish pale complexion, whiskey-colored curly hair, and the defeated look of someone who was beaten on a regular basis. She looked tired, cold, and far too thin. It made him angry to see it, and he was already too angry to be safe, so he forced his gaze away. There was a woman dressed in a business suit that echoed the warm chocolate of her skin. She didn't look quite like an Anna, but she carried herself in such a way that he could see her defying her alpha to call them a rock. She was obviously looking for someone. He almost started forward, but then her face changed as she found the person she was looking for, and it was not him. He started a second sweep of the airport when a small, hesitant voice from just to his left said,
"Sir, have you just come from Montana?"
It was the whiskey-haired girl. She must have approached him while he'd been looking elsewhere, something she wouldn't have been able to do if he weren't standing in the middle of a freaking airport. At least he didn't have to look for his father's contact anymore. With her this close, not even the artificial air currents could hide that she was a werewolf. But it wasn't his nose alone that told him that she was something far rarer. At first, he thought she was submissive. Most werewolves were more or less dominant. Gentler-natured people weren't usually cussed enough to survive the brutal transformation from human to werewolf, which meant that submissive werewolves were few and far between. Then he realized that the sudden change in his temper and the irrational desire to protect her from the crowd streaming past were indications of something else. She wasn't a submissive either, though many might mistake her for that. She was an Omega. Right then he knew that whatever else he did in Chicago, he was going to kill whoever had given her that bruised look. Up close, he was even more impressive. She could feel his energy licking lightly over her like a snake tasting its prey. Anna kept her gaze fully on the floor, waiting for his answer.
"I am Charles Cornick," he said, "the Maroc's son. You must be Anna."
She nodded.
"Did you drive here or catch a cab?"
"I don't have a car," she said.
He growled something she didn't quite catch.
"Can you drive?"
She nodded.
"Good."
She drove well, if a little overcautiously, which trait he didn't mind at all, though it didn't stop him from bracing one hand against the dash of the rental. She hadn't said anything when he told her to drive them to her apartment, though he hadn't missed the dismay she felt. He could have told her that his father had instructed him to keep her alive if he could, and to do that, he had to stick close. He didn't want to scare her any more than she already was. He could have told her that he had no intention of bedding her, but he tried not to lie, not even to himself. So he stayed silent. As she drove them down the expressway in the rented SUV, his wolf brother had gone from the killing rage caused by the crowded airplane to a relaxed contentment Charles had never felt before.
The two other Omega Wolves he'd met in his long lifetime had done something similar to him, but not to this extent.
This must be what it is like to be fully human.
The anger and the hunter's wariness that his wolf always held was only a faint memory, leaving behind only the determination to take this one to mate. Charles had never felt anything like that, either. She was pretty enough, though he'd like to feed her up and soften the stiff wariness in her shoulders. The wolf wanted to bed her and claim her as his own. Being of a more cautious nature than his wolf, he would wait until he knew her a little better before deciding to court her.
"My apartment isn't much," she said, in an obvious effort to break the silence. The small rasp in her voice told him that her throat was dry.
She was frightened of him. Being his father's chosen executioner, he was used to being feared, though he'd never enjoyed it. He leaned against the door to give her a little more space, and looked out at the city lights so she'd feel safe stealing a few glances at him if she wanted to. He'd been quiet, hoping she would get used to him, but he thought now that might have been a mistake.
"Don't worry," he told her. "I am not fussy. Whatever your apartment is like, it is doubtless more civilized than the Indian lodge I grew up in."
"An Indian lodge?"
"I'm a little older than I look," he said, smiling a little. 200 years ago, an Indian lodge was pretty fancy housing in Montana."
Like most old wolves, he didn't like talking about the past, but he found he'd do worse than that to set her at ease.
"I'd forgotten you might be older than you look," she said apologetically.
She'd seen the smile, he thought, because the level of her fear dropped appreciably.
"There aren't any older wolves in the pack here."
"A few," he disagreed with her as he noted that she said, "the pack," not "my pack."
Leo was 70 or 80, and his wife was a lot older than that. Old enough that they should have appreciated the gift of an Omega, instead of allowing her to be reduced to this abased child who cringed whenever he looked at her too long.
"It can be difficult to tell how old a wolf is. Most of us don't talk about it. It's hard enough adjusting without chatting incessantly about the old days."
She didn't reply, and he looked for something else they could talk about. Conversation wasn't his forte. He left that to his father and his brother, who both had clever tongues.
"What tribe are you from?" she asked before he found a topic. "I don't know a lot about the Montana tribes."
"My mother was Salish," he said, "of the Flathead tribe."
She snuck a quick look at his perfectly normal forehead. Ah, he thought, relieved. There was a good story he could tell her.
"Do you know how the Flatheads got their name?"
She shook her head. Her face was so solemn he was tempted to make something up to tease her. But she didn't know him well enough for that, so he told her the truth.
"Many of the Indian tribes in the Columbia Basin, mostly other Salish peoples, used to flatten the foreheads of their infants. The Flatheads were among the few tribes that did not."
"So why are they the ones called Flatheads?" she asked.
"Because the other tribes weren't trying to alter their foreheads, but to give themselves a peak at the top of their heads. Since the Flatheads did not, the other tribes called us Flatheads." It wasn't a compliment.
The scent of her fear faded further as she followed his story.
"We were the ugly barbarian cousins, you see."
He laughed.
"Ironically, the white trappers misunderstood the name. We were infamous for a long time for a practice we didn't follow. So the white men, like our cousins, thought we were barbarians."
"You said your mother was Salish," she said. "Is the Muroc Native American?"
He shook his head.
"Father is a Welshman. He came over and hunted furs in the days of the fur trappers and stayed because he fell in love with the scent of pine and snow."
His father put it just that way. Charles found himself smiling again, a real smile this time, and felt her relax further, and his face didn't hurt at all. He'd have to call his brother Samuel and tell him that he'd finally learned that his face wouldn't crack if he smiled. All it had taken to teach him was an Omega werewolf. She turned into an alley and pulled into a small parking lot behind one of the ubiquitous 4-story brick apartment buildings that filled the older suburbs of this part of town.
Which city are we in? He asked.
Oak Park, she said. Home of Frank Lloyd Wright, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and Scorchies.
Scorchies?
She nodded her head and hopped out of the car. The best Italian restaurant in Chicago, and my current place of employment.
Ah, that's why she smelled of garlic. So your opinion is unbiased?
He slid out of the car with a feeling of relief. His brother made fun of his dislike of cars, since even a bad accident was unlikely to kill him. But Charles wasn't worried about dying. It was just the cars went too fast. He couldn't get a feel for the land they passed through. And if he felt like dozing a bit as he traveled, they couldn't follow the trail on their own. He preferred horses. After he got his suitcase out of the back, Anna locked the car with the key fob. The car honked once, making him jump, and he gave it an irritated look. When he turned back, Anna was staring hard at the ground. The anger that being in her presence had dissipated surged back full force at the strength of her fear. Someone had really done a number on her.
Sorry, she whispered.
If she'd been in wolf form, she'd have been cowering with her tail tucked beneath her.
For what? He asked, unable to banish the rage that sent his voice down an octave. Because I'm jumpy around cars? Not your fault.
He was going to have to be careful this time, he realized, as he tried to pull the wolf back under control. Usually when his father sent him out to deal with trouble, he could do it coldly. But with a damaged Omega wolf around, one that he found himself responding to on several different levels, he was going to have to hold tight to his temper.
Anna, he said, fully in control again, I am my father's hitman. It is my job as his second. But that doesn't mean that I take pleasure in it. I am not going to hurt you, my word on it.
Yes, sir,
she said, clearly not believing him. He reminded himself that a man's word didn't count for much in this modern day. It helped his control that he scented as much anger on her as fear. She hadn't been completely broken. He decided that further attempts to reassure her were likely to do the opposite. She would have to learn to accept that he was a man of his word. In the meantime, he would give her something to think about.
Besides, he told her gently, my wolf is more interested in courting you than in asserting his dominance.
He walked past her before he smiled at the way her fear and anger had disappeared, replaced by shock, and something that might have been the beginning of interest. She had keys to the outer door of the building and led the way through the entry and up the stairs without looking at him at all. By the second flight, her scent had dulled of every emotion besides weariness. She was visibly dragging as she climbed the stairs to the top floor. Her hand shook as she tried to get her key into the deadbolt of one of the two doors at the top. She needed to eat more. Werewolves shouldn't let themselves get so thin. It could be dangerous to those around them. He was an executioner, he said, sent by his father to settle problems among the werewolves. He must be even more dangerous than Leo to have survived doing that job. She could feel how dominant he was, and she knew what dominants were like. She had to stay alert, ready for any aggressive moves he might make, ready to handle the pain and the panic so she didn't run and make him worse. So why was it that the longer he was around, the safer he made her feel? He followed her up all four flights of stairs without a word, and she refused to apologize again for her apartment. He'd invited himself, after all. It was his own fault that he'd end up sleeping on a twin-size futon instead of a nice hotel bed. She didn't know what to feed him. Hopefully he'd eaten while he traveled. Tomorrow she'd run out and get something. She had the check from Scorchies on her fridge awaiting deposit in the bank. There had once been a pair of two-bedroom apartments on her floor, but in the 70s someone had reapportioned the fourth floor into a three-bedroom and her studio. Her home looked shabby and empty, with no more furniture than her futon, a card table, and a pair of folding chairs. Only the polished oak floor gave it any appeal. She glanced at him as he walked through the doorway behind her, but his face revealed very little he didn't want it to. She couldn't see what he thought,
though she imagined his eyes lingered a little on the futon that worked fine for her, but was going to be much too small for him.
"The bathroom's through that door," she told him unnecessarily as the door stood open and the bathtub was clearly visible.
He nodded, watching her with eyes that were opaque in the dim illumination of her overhead light.
"Do you have to work tomorrow?" he asked.
"No, not until Saturday."
"Good. We can talk in the morning, then."
He took his small suitcase with him into the bathroom. She tried not to listen to the unfamiliar sounds of someone else getting ready for bed as she rummaged in her closet for the old blanket she kept in it, wishing again for a nice, cheap carpet instead of the gleaming hardwood floor that was pretty to look at, but cold on bare feet and sure to be hard on her backside when she tried to sleep. The door opened while she was kneeling on the floor, folding the blanket into a makeshift mattress as far as she could from where he would be sleeping.
"You can take the bed," she began as she turned around, and found herself at eye level with a large reddish-brown werewolf.
He wagged his tail and smiled at her obvious surprise before brushing past her and curling up on the blanket. He wiggled a bit, and then put his head down on his forepaws and closed his eyes, to all appearances dropping off immediately to sleep. She knew better, but he didn't stir as she went into the bathroom herself or when she came out dressed in her warmest pair of sweats. She wouldn't have been able to sleep with a man in her apartment, but somehow the wolf was less threatening. This wolf was less threatening. She bolted the door, turned out the light, and crawled into bed feeling safer than she had since the night she'd found out that there were monsters in the world. The footsteps on the stairs the next morning didn't bother her at first. The family who lived across from her was in and out at all times of the day or night. She pulled a pillow over her head to block the noise out, but then Anna realized the brisk, no-nonsense tread belonged to Kara and that she had a werewolf in her apartment. She sat bolt upright and looked at Charles. The wolf was more beautiful in the daylight than he had been at night. His fur really red, she saw, set off by black on his legs and paws. He raised his head when she sat up, and got to his feet when she did. She put a finger to her lips as Kara knocked sharply on the door.
"Anna, you in there, girl? Did you know that someone is parked in your spot again? Do you want me to call the tow truck, or do you have a man in there for once?"
Kara wouldn't just go away.
"I'm here. Just a minute."
She looked around frantically. But there was nowhere to hide a werewolf. He wouldn't fit in the closet, and if she closed the bathroom door, Kara would want to know why, just as she'd demand to know why Anna suddenly had a dog the size of an Irish wolfhound and not nearly as friendly-looking in her living room. She gave Charles one last frantic look, and then hurried over to the door as he trotted off to the bathroom. She heard it click shut behind him as she unbolted the door.
"I'm back," said Kara breezily as she came in, setting a pair of bags down on the table.
Her dark-as-night skin looked richer than usual for her week of tropical sun.
"I stopped on the way home and bought some breakfast for us. You don't eat enough to keep a mouse alive."
Her gaze caught on the closed bathroom door.
"You do have someone here."
She smiled, but her eyes were wary. Kara had made no secret of the fact that she didn't like Justin, who Anna had explained away, truthfully enough, as an old boyfriend. Anna was miserably aware that Kara wouldn't leave until she saw who was in the bathroom. For some reason, Kara had taken Anna under her wing the very first day she'd moved in, shortly after she'd been changed. Just then, Charles opened the bathroom door and stepped just through the doorway.
"Do you have a rubber band, Anna?"
He was fully dressed and human, but Anna knew that was impossible. It had been less than 5 minutes since he'd gone into the bathroom, and a werewolf took a lot longer than that to change back to human form. She cast a frantic glance at Kara, but her neighbor was too busy staring at the man in the bathroom doorway to take note of Anna's shock. Kara's rapt gaze made Anna take a second look as well. She had to admit that Charles, his blue-black hair hanging free to his waist in a thick sheet that made him look strangely naked, despite his perfectly respectable flannel shirt and jeans, was worth staring at. He gave Kara a small smile before turning his attention back to Anna.
I seem to have misplaced my hairband. Do you have another one?
She gave him a jerky nod and brushed past him into the bathroom. How had he changed so fast? She could hardly ask him how he'd done it with Kara in the room, however. He smelled good. Even after 3 years, it was disconcerting to notice such things about people. Usually she tried to ignore what her nose told her, but she had to force herself not to stop and take a deep lungful of his rich scent.
"And just who are you?" Anna heard Kara ask suspiciously.
"Charles Cornick."
She couldn't tell by the sound of his voice whether he was bothered by Kara's unfriendliness or not.
"You are..."
"This is Kara, my downstairs neighbor," Anna told him, handing him a hairband as she slipped by him and back into the main room. "Sorry, I should have introduced you. Kara, meet Charles Cornick, who is visiting from Montana. Charles, meet Kara Mosley, my downstairs neighbor. Now shake and be nice."
She'd meant the admonition for Kara, who could be acerbic if she took a dislike to someone, but Charles raised an eyebrow at her before he turned back to Kara and offered a long-fingered hand.
"From Montana?" asked Kara as she took his hand and shook it firmly once. He nodded and began French braiding his hair with quick, practiced motions.
"My father sent me out here because he'd heard there was a man giving Anna a bad time."
And with that one statement, Anna knew he won Kara over completely.
"Justin, you're going to take care of that rat bastard?"
She gave Charles an appraising look.
"Now, you're in good shape, don't get me wrong, but Justin is a bad piece of business. I lived in Cabrini Green until my mama got smart and married her a good man. Those projects, though, they grew a certain sort of predator, the kind that loves violence for its own sake. That Justin, he has dead eyes. Sent me back 20 years the first time I saw him. He's hurt people before and liked it. You're not going to frighten him off with just a warning."
The corner of Charles's lip turned up, and his eyes warmed, changing his appearance entirely.
"Thank you for the heads up," he told her.
Kara gave him a regal nod.
"If I know Anna, there's not an ounce of food to be found in the whole apartment. You need to feed that girl up. There's bagels and cream cheese in those bags on the table, and no, I don't mean to stay. I got a week's worth of work waiting on me, but I couldn't go without knowing that Anna would eat something."
"I'll see that she does," Charles told her,
the small smile still on his face. Kara reached way up and patted his cheek in a motherly gesture.
"Thank you."
She gave Anna a quick hug and pulled an envelope out of her pocket and set it on the table next to the bagels.
"You take this for watching the cat so I don't have to take him to the kennels with all those dogs he hates and pay them 4 times this amount. I find it in my cookie jar again, and I'll take him to the kennels just for spite because it'll make you feel guilty."
Then she was gone. Anna waited until the sound of her footsteps reached the next landing, then said, "How did you change so fast?"
"Do you want garlic or blueberry?" Charles asked, opening the bag.
When she didn't answer his question, he put both hands on the table and sighed.
"You mean you haven't heard the story of the Maroc and his Indian maiden?"
She couldn't read his voice, and his face was tilted away from her, so she couldn't read that either.
"No," she said.
He gave a short laugh, though she didn't think there was any humor behind it.
"My mother was beautiful, and it saved her life. She'd been out gathering herbs and surprised a moose. It ran over her, and she was dying from it when my father, attracted by the noise, came upon her. He saved my mother's life by turning her into a werewolf."
He took out the bagels and set them on the table with napkins. He sat down and waved her to the other seat.
"Start eating, and I'll tell you the rest of the story."
He'd given her the blueberry one. She sat opposite him and took a bite. He gave a satisfied nod, and then continued.
"It was one of those love-at-first-sight things on both their parts, apparently. Must have been looks, because neither one of them could speak the other's language at first. All was well until she became pregnant. My mother's father was a person of magic, and he helped her when she told him that she needed to stay human until I was born. So every month, when my father and brother hunted under the moon, she stayed human. And every moon, she grew weaker and weaker. My father argued with her, and with her father, worried that she was killing herself."
"Why did she do that?" Anna asked.
Charles frowned at her.
How long have you been a werewolf?
3 years last August.
Werewolf women can't have children, he said. The change is too hard on the fetus. They miscarry in the third or fourth month.
Anna stared at him. No one had ever told her that.
Are you all right?
She didn't know how to answer him. She hadn't exactly been planning on having children, especially as weird as her life had been for the last few years. She just hadn't planned on not having children either.
This should have been explained to you before you chose to change, he said.
It was her turn to laugh. No one explained anything. No, it's all right. Please tell me the rest of your story.
He watched her for a long moment, then gave her an oddly solemn nod.
Despite my father's protests, she held out until my birth. Weakened by the magic of fighting the moon's call, she did not survive it. I was born a werewolf, not changed as all the rest are. It gives me a few extra abilities, like being able to change fast.
That would be nice, she said with feeling.
It still hurts, he added.
She played with a piece of bagel.
Are you going to look for the missing boy?
His mouth tightened.
No, we know where Alan Fraser is.
Something in his voice told her.
He's dead?
He nodded.
There are some good people looking into his death. They'll find out who is responsible. He was changed without his consent. The girl who was with him was killed. Then he was sold to be used as a laboratory guinea pig. The person responsible will pay for their crimes.
She started to ask him something more, but the door to her apartment flew open and hit the wall behind it, leaving Justin standing in the open doorway. She'd been so intent on Charles, she hadn't heard Justin coming up the stairs. She'd forgotten to lock her door after Kara left. Not that it would have done her much good. Justin had a key to her apartment. She couldn't help her flinch as he strode through the door as if he owned the place.
Payday, he said. You owe me a check.
He looked at Charles.
Time for you to go. The lady and I have some business.
Anna couldn't believe that even Justin would take that tone with Charles. She looked at him to gauge his reaction and saw why Justin had put his foot in it. Charles was fussing with his plate, his eyes on his hands. All his awesome force of personality was bottled up and stuffed somewhere it didn't show.
I don't think I'd better go, he murmured, still looking down. She might need my help.
Justin's lip curled.
Where'd you pick this one up, bitch? Wait until I let Leo know you found a stray and haven't told him about it.
He crossed the room and took a handful of her hair. He used it to force her to her feet and up against the wall, shoving her with a hip in a gesture that was both sexual and violent. He leaned his face into hers.
Just you wait. Maybe he'll decide to let me punish you again. I'd like that.
She remembered the last time he'd been allowed to punish her and couldn't suppress her reaction. He enjoyed her panic and was pressed close enough that she could feel it.
I don't think that she's the one who is going to be punished, Charles said, his voice still soft.
But something in Anna loosened. He wouldn't let Justin hurt her. She couldn't have said why she knew that. She'd certainly found out that just because a wolf wouldn't hurt her didn't mean he would stop anyone else from hurting her.
I didn't tell you to talk, Justin snarled, his head snapping away from her so he could glare at the other man. I'll deal with you when I'm finished.
The legs of Charles's chair made a rough sound on the floor as he stood. Anna could hear him dust off his hands lightly.
I think you are finished here, he said in a completely different voice. Let her go.
She felt the power of those words go through her bones and warm her stomach, which had been chill with fear. Justin liked to hurt her even more than he desired her unwilling body. She'd fought him until she realized that pleased him even more. She learned quickly that there was no way for her to win a struggle between them. He was stronger and faster, and the only time she'd broken away from him, the rest of the pack had held her for him. At Charles's words, though, Justin released her so quickly that she staggered, though that didn't slow her down as she ran as far away from him as she could get, which was the kitchen. She picked up the marble rolling pin that had been her grandmother's and held it warily.
Justin had his back to her, but Charles saw her weapon, and briefly his eyes smiled at her before he turned his attention to Justin.
"Who the hell are you?"
Justin spat, but Anna heard beyond the anger to fear.
"I could return the question," said Charles. "I have a list of all the werewolves in the Chicago packs, and your name is not on it. But that is only part of my business here. Go home and tell Leo that Charles Cornick is here to talk with him. I will meet him at his house at 7 this evening. He may bring his first five and his mate, but the rest of his pack will stay away."
To Anna's shock, Justin snarled once, but with no more protest than that, he left. 2. The wolf who scared Anna so badly hadn't wanted to leave, but he wasn't dominant enough to do anything about it as long as Charles was watching, which was why Charles waited a few seconds and then quietly followed him down the stairs. The next flight down, he found Justin standing in front of a door prepared to knock on it. He was pretty sure it was Kara's door. Somehow it didn't surprise him that Justin would look for another way to punish Anna for his forced retreat. Charles scuffed his boot on the stairs and watched the other wolf stiffen and drop his arm.
"Kara's not home," Charles told him, "and hurting her would not be advisable."
Charles wondered if he should just kill him now, but he had a reputation that his father couldn't afford for him to lose. He only killed those who broke the Maroc's rules, and he only did it after their guilt was established. Anna had told his father that Justin was the wolf who changed Alan Mackenzie Fraser against his will, but since there were so many things wrong in this pack, there might have been mitigating circumstances. Anna had been a werewolf for 3 years, and no one had told her that she could not have children. If Anna knew so little, then it was more than possible that this wolf didn't know the rules either. Whether the wolf was ignorant of his crimes or not, Charles still wanted to kill him. When Justin turned around to face him, Charles let his beast peer out of his eyes and watched the other wolf blanch and start back down the stairs.
"You should find Leo and give him the message," Charles said.
This time he let Justin know that he was following him, let him feel a little the way it was to be prey for a larger predator. He was tough, this Justin. He kept turning around to confront Charles, only to meet his eyes and be forced away again. The chase aroused his wolf, and Charles, still angry at the way Justin had manhandled Anna, let the wolf out just a little more than he should have. It was a fight to stop at the outside door and let Justin go free. The wolf had been given a hunt, and it was much, much too short. Brother Wolf hadn't liked seeing Anna frightened either. He'd staked his claim, and it had taken all of Charles's control not to just kill Justin in Anna's apartment. Only the strong suspicion that she'd go back to being afraid of him had allowed him to stay seated until he was sure he could control himself. Climbing 4 flights of stairs should have given him enough time to silence the wolf. It might have, except that Anna was waiting for him, rolling pin in hand, on the landing below her apartment. He paused halfway up the stairs, and she turned around without a word. He stalked her back to her apartment and into the kitchen area, where she set the rolling pin on its stand, right next to a small pot that held a handful of knives.
"Why the rolling pin and not a knife?" he asked, his voice raspy with the need for action.
She looked at him for the first time since she'd seen his face on the stairs.
"A knife wouldn't even slow him down, but bones take time to heal."
He liked that. Who'd have thought he'd get turned on by a woman with a rolling pin?
"All right," he said. "All right."
He turned abruptly and left her standing in front of the counter, because if he'd stayed there, he would have taken her, seduced her. The apartment wasn't large enough either to pace or to get much distance between them. Her scent, blended with fear and arousal, was dangerous. He needed a distraction. He pulled one of the chairs around and sat on it, leaning back until it was propped on 2 legs. He folded his arms behind his head and assumed a deliberately relaxed posture,
half closed his eyes, and said,
"I want you to tell me about your change."
He hadn't missed the clues, he thought, watching her flinch a little. There was something wrong with how she'd been changed. He focused on that.
"Why?" she asked, challenging him, still caught up in the adrenaline rush of Justin's visit, he imagined.
She caught herself and turned away, cringing, as if she expected him to explode. He closed his eyes entirely. Another moment, and he was going to put all the gentlemanly behavior his father had taught him aside and take her, willing or not. Oh, that would teach her not to be afraid of him, he thought.
"I need to know how Leo's pack is run," he told her patiently, though at the moment he couldn't have cared less. "I'd rather do that through your impressions first, and then I'll ask you questions. It'll give me a better insight into what he's doing and why."
Anna gave him a wary look, but he hadn't moved. She could still smell the anger in the air, but it might just have been a remnant from when Justin had been there. Charles was aroused, too, and she found herself responding to it, though she knew it was a common result of victorious confrontations among males. He was ignoring it, so she could, too. She took a deep breath, and his scent filled her lungs. Clearing her throat, she tried to find the beginning of her story.
"I was working in a music store in the Loop when I first met Justin. He told me he was a guitarist like me, and he started coming in a couple of times a week buying strings, music, small ticket stuff. He'd flirt and tease."
She gave an exasperated huff for her foolishness.
"I thought he was a nice guy, so when he asked me out for lunch, I said, sure."
She looked at Charles, but he looked as though he might have fallen asleep. The muscles in his shoulders were relaxed, and his breathing was slow and easy. "We dated a couple of times. He took me to this little restaurant near a park, one of the forest preserves. When we were finished, he took me for a walk in the woods. To look at the moon, he told me."
Even now, with the night long over, she could hear the tension in her voice. "He asked me to wait a minute, said he'd be right back."
He'd been excited, she remembered, almost frantic with suppressed emotion. He patted his pockets, then said he'd left something in his car. She'd been worried that he had gone to get an engagement ring. She'd practiced gentle ways of saying no while she waited. They had very little in common and no chemistry at all. Though he seemed nice enough, she'd been getting the feeling that there was something a little off about him, too, and her instincts told her that she needed to break it off.
"It took longer than a minute, and I was just about to go back to the car myself when I heard something in the bushes."
The skin on her face tingled with fear, just as it had that night.
"You didn't know he was a werewolf?"
Charles's voice reminded her that she was safe in her apartment.
"No, I thought that werewolves were just stories."
"Tell me about after the attack."
She didn't need to tell him about how Justin had stalked her for an hour, herding her back from the edge of the preserve every time she came close to getting out. He only wanted to know about Leo's pack. Anna hid her sigh of relief.
"I woke up in Leo's house. He was excited at first. His pack only has one other woman. Then they discovered what I am."
"And what are you, Anna?"
His voice was like smoke, she thought, soft and weightless.
"Submissive," she said. "The lowest of the low."
And then, because his eyes were still closed, she added,
"Useless."
"Is that what they told you?"
he asked thoughtfully.
"It's the truth."
She ought to be more upset about it. The wolves who didn't despise her treated her with pity, but she didn't want to be dominant and have to fight and hurt people. He didn't say anything, so she continued her story, trying to give him all the details she could remember. He asked some questions.
"Who helped you gain control of the wolf?"
"No one. She'd done that on her own. Another black mark against her that proved she wasn't dominant, they told her."
"Who gave you the Morocco's phone number?"
"Leo's third, Boyd Hamilton."
"When and why?"
"Just before Leo's mate stepped in and stopped him from passing Anna around to whatever male he wanted to reward. Anna tried to avoid the higher-ranking wolves. She had no idea why he'd given her that number, and no desire to ask."
"How many new members have come into the pack since you?"
"3, all male. but two of them couldn't control themselves and had to be killed.
How many members of the pack?
26. When she finally wound down to a stop, she was almost surprised to find herself sitting on the floor across the room from Charles with her back against the wall. Slowly, Charles let his chair drop back to the floor and pinched the bridge of his nose. He sighed heavily and then looked at her directly for the first time since she'd begun speaking. She sucked in her breath at the bright gold of his eyes. He was very near a change forced by some strong emotion, and despite seeing his eyes, she couldn't read it in his body or his scent. He'd managed to mask it from her.
There are rules. First is that no person may be changed against their will. Second is that no person may be changed until they have been counseled and passed a simple test to demonstrate that they understand what that change means.
She didn't know what to say, but she finally remembered to drop her eyes away from his intense stare.
From what you've said, Leo is adding new wolves and missing others. He didn't report that to the Maroc. Last year he came to our annual meeting with his mate and his fourth, that Boyd Hamilton, and told us that his second and third were tied up.
Anna frowned at him. Boyd's been his third for as long as I've been in the pack, and Justin is his second.
You said that there is only one female in the pack besides you?
Yes.
There should have been four.
No one has mentioned any others, she told him. He looked over at the check on her fridge.
They take your paycheck. How much do they give you back?
His voice was bass deep with the heat of the change behind it. 60%?
Ah.
He closed his eyes again and breathed deeply. She could smell the musk of his anger now, though his shoulders still looked relaxed. When he didn't say anything more, she said quietly,
Is there anything I can do to help? Do you want me to leave or talk or turn on music?
She didn't have a TV, but she still had her old stereo. His eyes stayed closed, but he smiled, just a twitch of his lips.
My control is usually better than this.
She waited, but it seemed to get worse rather than better. His eyes snapped open, and his cold yellow gaze pinned her against the wall where she sat as he uncoiled and prowled across the room. Her pulse jumped unsteadily, and she bowed her head, curling up to be smaller. She felt rather than saw him crouch in front of her. His hands, when they cupped her face, were so hot she flinched and regretted it when he growled. He dropped to his knees, nuzzling against her neck, then rested his body, now taut as iron, against hers, trapping her between him and the wall. He put his hands on the wall, one to each side of her, and then quit moving. His breath was hot on her neck. She sat as still as she could, terrified of doing anything that might break his control. But there was something about him that kept her from being truly scared, something that insisted he wouldn't hurt her, that he never would hurt her. Which was stupid. All the dominants hurt those beneath them. She had had that beaten into her more than once. Just because she could heal quickly didn't make getting hurt pleasant. But no matter how much she told herself she ought to be frightened of him, a dominant among dominants, a strange man she'd never seen before last night, or, more accurately, very early this morning, she couldn't be. Though he smelled of anger, he also smelled like spring rain, wolf, and man. She closed her eyes and quit fighting, letting the sweet sharpness of his scent wash away the fear and anger aroused by telling this man about the worst thing that ever happened to her. As soon as she relaxed, he did as well. His rigid muscles loosened, and his imprisoning arms slid down the wall to rest lightly on her shoulders. After a while, he pulled away slowly, but stayed crouched so his head was only slightly higher than hers. He put a gentle thumb under her chin and raised her head until she gazed into his dark eyes. She had the sudden feeling that if she could look into those eyes for the rest of her life, she would be happy. It scared her a lot more than his anger had.
Are you doing something to me to make me feel like this?
She asked the question before she had time to censor herself. He didn't ask her how he made her feel. Instead, he tilted his head, a wolf-like gesture, but kept eye contact, though there was no challenge in his scent. Instead, she had the impression he was almost as bewildered as she was.
I don't think so. Certainly not on purpose.
He cupped her face in both of his hands. They were large hands and calloused, and they trembled just a little. He bent down until his chin rested on the top of her head.
I've never felt this way before, either.
He could have stayed there forever, despite the discomfort of kneeling on the hardwood floor. He'd never felt anything like this, certainly not with a woman he'd known less than 24 hours. He didn't know how to deal with it, didn't want to deal with it, and, most unlike himself, was willing to put off dealing with it indefinitely, as long as he could spend the time with her body against his. Of course, there was something he'd rather do, but if he wasn't mistaken, there was someone else coming up the stairs. 4 flights of stairs were evidently not enough to keep intruders away. He closed his eyes and let his wolf brother sort through the scents and identify their newest visitor. There was a knock at the door. Anna jerked back out of his hold, sucking in her breath. Part of him was pleased that he'd managed to distract her so much that she hadn't noticed anything until then. Part of him worried at her vulnerability. Reluctantly, he stood up and put a little distance between them.
Come in, Isabel.
The door opened, and Leo's mate stuck her head in. She took a good look at Anna and grinned mischievously.
Interrupting something interesting?
He'd always liked Isabel, though he'd tried hard not to show it. As his father's executioner, he'd long ago learned not to get close to anyone he might someday have to kill, which made his circle of friends very small. His father and his brother, for the most part. Anna stood up and returned Isabel's smile with a shy one of her own, though he could tell she was still shaken. To his surprise, though, she said,
"Yes, there was something very interesting going on. Come in anyway."
Once the invitation had been issued, Isabel blew in like the March wind, as she usually did, simultaneously shutting the door and holding out a hand to Charles.
"Charles, it is so good to see you."
He took her hand and bowed over it, kissing it lightly. It smelled of cinnamon and cloves. He'd forgotten that about her, that she used perfume with an eye toward the sharpness of werewolf senses, just strong enough to mask herself and so give her some protection from the sharp noses of her fellow wolves. Unless she was extremely agitated, no one could tell how she felt from her scent.
"You look beautiful," he said, as he knew she expected.
It was true enough.
"I should be looking a nervous wreck," she said, running the hand Charles had kissed through her airy, feathery-cut hair that, combined with her fine features, made her look like a fairy princess.
She was shorter than Anna and finer-boned, but Charles had never made the mistake of thinking of her as fragile.
"Justin came boiling in with some nonsense about a meeting tonight. He was all but incoherent. Why did you enrage the boy like that?" "And I told Leo I'd drop by to see what you were doing."
This was why he didn't make friends.
"Leo received my message?" Charles asked.
She nodded, and looked quite frightened, which is not a good look for him, as I told him. She leaned forward and put a too familiar hand on his arm.
"What has brought you to our territory, Charles?"
He stepped back. He didn't much like to touch or be touched, though he seemed to have largely forgotten that while he was around Anna. His Anna. Forcefully, he brought his attention back to business.
"I have come to meet with Leo tonight."
Isabel's usually cheerful face hardened, and he waited for her to blow up at him. Isabel was as famous for her temper as she was for her charisma. She was one of the few people to blow up in the Morocco's face and get away with it. Charles's father liked Isabel, too. But she didn't say anything more to him. Instead, she turned her head to glance at Anna, whom, he suddenly realized, she'd been pointedly ignoring up to that point. When she returned her gaze to Charles, she began speaking, but not to him.
"What tales have you been carrying, Anna, my dear? Complaining about your place in the pack? Choose a mate if you don't like it. I've told you that before. Justin would take you, I'm sure."
There was no venom in her voice. Maybe if Charles hadn't already met Justin, he'd have missed the way Anna's face paled. Maybe he wouldn't have heard the threat. Anna didn't say anything. Isabel continued to stare at Charles, though she was careful to keep from meeting his eyes. He thought she was studying his reaction.